So welcome, everyone. This is our continuation of a year-long theme into the Four Noble Truths, and we are also on the Eightfold Path. It's also the beginning of a 10-week series, so we would appreciate people paying up front if they could or would, so that we could have that commitment to come to the 10 weeks, the totality of those 10 weeks, and we also appreciate, for financial reasons, having that done in advance as well. So if you're interested, it's $50 for these 10 weeks. And, of course, if you can't afford that amount, whatever amount you can afford is fine. So this particular talk is the second of the talks on wise effort. This one is entitled The Art and Science of Practice. The Art and Science of Practice. And I'd just like to do a broad brushstroke to begin with. And I've been thinking a lot about how there's an evolution to this immediacy. Sounds contradictory, but then when we talk spiritual matters, we often seem paradoxical. But the truth is that for most people, just to be interested in coming to a class that has a spiritual journey of depth and understanding as its focus, you have to have evolved through a certain critical point in life and your assessment of life so that you begin to reassess it away from the way the economy and our leadership seems to point in the directions of gain and acquisition and all of this different ways that we are taught as children to believe that life would be and could be meaningful to us. And as we take and begin to journey with some seriousness and some degree of dedication and purpose into our spiritual practice, we will evolve through that. And the first of these Eightfold Path topics, wise view and wise intention, you can hold wise view and you can look for the deepest sense of longing in you without, even when you're beginning to practice, you can get a sense of interconnection and that this practice doesn't go about giving you much as an individual separate thing. It's really meant to bring us together in union. And we can work it that way for some time just in the consideration of that, just in the reflection of that, just in the contemplation of what that means to our life. And we can also get a sense of the resonance of some deep longing towards that end, which we perhaps cannot articulate well, but we have a feeling that's pulling us deeper into ourselves and towards that sense of inner connection and outer connection and somehow union of all of those. Now, the real evolution comes when we start talking about effort, because we're going to move in accordance with our belief systems with effort. And we really can't bring a kind of clear view of what effort should be. All we know is the effort that we need to make, the effort that feels legitimate for each of us to do at any particular time in our practice or all along the spiritual road. And this effort evolves. It changes according to how we understand the sense of I, me, and mine, how we understand this embody this sense of self. We can't go faster than we want to. It's a little bit like going too fast in a marathon in the beginning. You suffer for it in the end. And believe me, I'm not trying to get you to go faster than what you and how you need to go. Each of us have a particular pace, and we have to assert the effort that we feel is right for that pace, as well as the effort that we know to be true for ourselves. But as our self, in quotation marks, changes, so does the extension of our effort made by our self. Now, what can happen is that I don't want to push you faster, than your pace or where you happen to be in this moment, in this leg of your journey. But there can be tremendous resistance to moving in accordance with your understanding. The problem isn't that you'll move too fast, it's that you'll drag your feet. Okay, so that is what I want to really address tonight. Because there's pain associated with dragging your feet and not looking around. Many of us are stuck in the effort we make because often of the psychological issues associated with that particular form of effort that we are displaying. Let me just give you an example. I know that there are some Buddhists who would rather not worry about their psychological issues, but that's not this group. We're looking right at them, all right? We're not going to pretend that somehow spiritually we can surmount the spiritual mountain without having to deal with the pain of what pulls us backward. And often there are two issues that are paramount to someone's dragging their feet in effort. Remember that effort in its entire evolution is really goes from self-assertion and willful force of power and you doing it on your own for yourself and all of that towards effortless living. Effortless living, as recounted by the Buddha in the Sutta Nipata that I'll read again tonight. So that's the range of the effort. That's the evolution. That's the continuum of where this effort goes. And what happens is that we get sidetracked along that continuum. We keep ourselves from moving forth, from moving on. Even though we may have some understanding, what happens is our psychological issues are like a rope, a tether, that keep us bound to one particular place on that continuum. And one of those main forms of dragging that goes on is mistrust. Now effortless living requires complete faith, complete relaxation with the world, non-resistance. I keep framing the meditation path in terms of non-resistance, of deep relaxation, deep ease, so that we have no boundary issues, so that we don't keep placing ourselves in opposition to events, experiences, etc. But that takes enormous amount of trust to do that, doesn't it? And many of us have unresolved trust issues. We were perhaps scarred early on in our childhood, and we have never tested the waters of trust, even though we have long since grown out of those circumstances. And we find ourselves in kind of contempt of even thinking of ourselves in a trusting way in relationship to life or others around us. We're so scarred in that issue that we won't really begin to look at the fear associated with it. Now, this will hold you steadfast in place. This issue, if not understood and examined, will bind you in that evolution of your understanding of effort and yourself, because you will move in your effort in accordance with your self-understanding. As that self-understanding changes, so will the effort you put forward. But if we are frozen in a particular place, then that effort will hold us in that kind of holding pattern. And trust is one of those issues that just absolutely deadens our pace. So I don't have time tonight to really explore these issues with any depth, but I leave them to you. I mean, we have explored trust in a number of other talks along the way, but it's really up to you to move this thing forward where you know you need to do so. Just don't pretend that you don't have or we don't have these issues when they start resonating with you. When trust is said and your ears pick up, that usually indicates that there's something there that we need to attend to. The other one, along the same themes really, is anti-authority issues. This kind of self-reliance, this sort of, and Seattle, with all of its benefit and all of its positive energy, has an abundance of this kind of self-reliance, don't tell me, this isolating sense of independence, which you can hear by the very words are antithesis to interconnection, to really learning from one another, to being able to hold and to move in a way that allows us to share our experiences, to feel both not codependent in the best sense of that word, cooperatively dependent. And so, again, I would suggest really looking at that, if that's a particular issue. And often in Vipassana meditators and with Vipassana meditators, that is one of the main reasons you chose this over, say, Zen or a Tibetan flavor of Buddhism. You like it your way. So I'd just like to give a personal example of how this evolution of effort can sometimes be dramatically moved from one place to another. And because I had both issues of trust and authority, and was bound and determined to do it my way and not to have to listen too much to anyone, including teachers of mine, and being very stubborn. And I don't say that in any kind of eye-blinking way. Sometimes we do that with certain traits, like that's really a good trait, but we say that it's not. No, this is not a good trait. there's no wink there. I was stubborn, which meant I wouldn't listen. I still have that quality comes up. In any case, so I did a number of years of meditation practice at the meditation center. Then I journeyed off to Burma by myself and ordained in Burma. One of the first people to ordain in a number of years there, because it was and continues to be such a entrenched military society. And each time I would come to an interview during the 5 months I was there, the teacher, no matter what I said to him, I could have said I stayed up all night and sat nonstop, and he would have ended the interview saying, "Please try harder." And I took that literally. So I would try harder. And then there was a moment somewhere along the line there where I knew that this was not working. And I really felt that if I continued, I was very fragile in my tenor of just how I held things, and and where I could have just snapped at any particular moment. And so I left that, and making a long story short, found my way to Thailand. And there I just lived in the forest, and I didn't have anyone that I was seeing every day teaching me, and I let the forest and I let nature and I allowed myself to be affected by natural surround. And I found myself beginning to move in accordance with the laws of life as I lived them, rather than this inward, willful, and often self-unkind display of effort. So I had to be taken to the limits of my own will in order to give them up, in order to feel the pain and the limitation of that particular direction. I hope you don't have to go that far, and I hope you're not as stubborn as I am, and I don't mean that with any kind of wink. I mean literally, I hope you're not, because it would save you an awful lot of pain. Because the downside of that is that you begin to feel your pain. Now, as effort changes and evolves, so do our interests. What we're interested in, as the sense of self becomes less critical, there's less investment in I, me, and mine, then there's also less investment in particular forms of interest that the self engenders. And one of those is the interest in having great experiences and meditation. It just changes where you don't really, it's not that big of a deal what experience you're having in meditation. And it doesn't say that much about you, which is why it's not that much of a big deal. If you're having a bad sitting, it's a bad sitting. If you're having an elated sitting, that's what it is. It's not any sense of, it doesn't mean anything, to be honest. It's just an experience. And experiences become less and less prominent and less important as effort becomes less willful. Now, at this point, I want to move this language into what I call the science and art of meditation, because the science is really the mechanics, the assurance that we take within the mechanics, and the relaxation we take within that assurance. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean, when you first heard the Buddha's path, it seems all very logical, and we connect with it. We find a meditation practice that feels comfortable to us. And we have been told by our teachers that there have been countless beings before us who have traveled this path and have had the payoff of then the fruits of the path. And so we get excited and we start applying ourselves to the mechanics of the meditation, getting it right, doing it from this sense of zeal. We believe in the mechanics. We believe that if other people have just followed this particular direction of meditation, and we will listen closely to what the teacher says and what the teacher promises and what he or she says, and we will put in our time to do just that. So it's just like going to school, really. I mean, read the textbooks, take notes, and you probably will pass the course. And so it's reproducible. It's something that I can see Jim doing, and I'm doing it as well. And if I sit as long as Jim, quite likely at some period of time, I will be able to connect with as many breaths as Jim on the graph of time over breaths. Breaths noticed, not number of times you breathe. And there will be a payoff in this. There's no question about it. And and that payoff will confirm my effort. It will confirm something. I will see myself gaining in concentration. Now, let me just say that cultivation, this kind of cultivation, is often encouraged from some meditation teachers, some Buddhist teachers. And there is a point to it. I am not in any way deriding this particular way. But I will show you the value of it. This is the value of it. And I'll also show you the limitations, because then we'll be free of it once we know those two things. The value of it is just this, that it's very graphable. The payoff is very predictable. It's a progression. It's a progression. And you'll have certain experiences. Remember that word, please, from what I just said a few moments ago. You'll have certain experiences that seem to confirm textbooks' indication that you are moving somewhere. And this whole sense of cultivation gives you a willingness to keep trying because you feel like you're moving. Early on, almost all of us, have to have that sense of going somewhere. And we have to see progress to where we think we're going. Or why would we do it? We're not going to just, there's too much doubt in this business to continue when nothing is happening, and just because somebody says it will at some point, so what? You know, you've been told a lot of lies in your life. And so that, why believe this one? And so we need to see some kind of progress in ourselves. And so when we're able to stay on three breaths rather than no breath at all for a period of time, that's great progress, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Now, as we begin to march to practice in terms of its science, its predictable results, this is very satisfying to the sense of self because we are mastering it. We're doing it, and we put forth that effort. If we want to put forth more effort, more results. Less effort, less results. Don't sit, your life will fall apart. Sit a lot, and it'll come back together. I mean, it's pretty simple in that equation. And we get a great sense of self-fulfillment from that. Okay, and there's nothing wrong with that, and part of the practice depends upon that form of cultivation in order to nurture certain qualities of mind that are very important to insight. So it almost uses, as Buddha nature often does, it uses your unwise intention to bring wise results, unbeknownst to you, which will later be used for your gain. At that point, you won't care whether you gain or not, but never mind. You see how the whole thing is like weird, isn't it? It's all weird. It's very weird. Okay, but what we have to do in order not to get arrested in this particular expression of effort, two things, remember. One is to know the psychological indications that arrest us, which I mentioned just a couple of. There can be a number of, but this, I mentioned mistrust and authority. The other is that you have to start seeing the limitations, how you're hurting by doing and exerting this effort. What's hurting? How do you hurt? You see, don't just look at where you're going, and if you're going through the briar patch, notice the scars that the briar patch is having. You see? And one of those is that you start having, oh, just a small thing, you start being, having, you're full of views and opinions. You know the right way, you're on the right way, and you'll fight anybody else who thinks that they know the right way if it doesn't happen to coincide with your own. And it doesn't make you a very easy to get along with person. And I certainly had my moments in which those views and opinions played forth, and I wasn't a very likable guy, as they will in all of us, And you get, but here's the catcher for those of you who really understand where the meditation is headed, and that is that you start getting rigid in your heart. It starts feeling cold and drab and lifeless. And you wonder where the juice is. And distant, emotionally cold, and just because mechanics do that. Science, although predictable, you're not being affected. The will, the need, the force of effort itself is keeping you from being affected. You're putting in so much strength that you aren't receiving. You're moving forward, leaning into. That you're not being fed spiritually in this practice. And yet, some people are so stubborn, and I raise my hand, that they think they're going to bust through somehow using this methodology, bust through to some kind of glamour, spiritual glamour on the other end of this dryness. I just haven't worked hard enough. I just haven't done it long enough. And then 5 months later, please try harder, and you want to hit the guy. And you're dead inside. You're dead inside. You feel nothing. Oh, I don't mean, that's a little too severe. You feel something. Mostly you feel your self-hatred. Because that, in general, is what has been driving us. When we are that interested in getting outside of ourself and looking for something other than what I am, which is often what is behind the effort, which is another reason that effort will not be overcome when you hate the person who's you're trying to overcome. You're not going to fall back on that person. and say, okay, I have to do, you want to keep overcoming that person. You want to keep getting out of that person's skin. You see how these psychological issues play forth in the very forms and expression of the effort we use. That's why we have to clean all this up, or we just stay dead. We're just stagnant in water. This thing moves in accordance to your sincerity and my sincerity. It doesn't move any faster. You can't fool it. It's not like, you know, you have a teacher and, you know, if you sort of knew that he was a, or she was a, had a hobby and you could go up and talk to that person, you know how you, then you could maybe get a higher grade. You can't do that in spiritual work. You can't, there's no, I like that. I like that because I always hated those people who did that kind of thing when I was working so hard. You can't fool it. You can't, there's no way to charm your way through this. You see? It's dead stop, and we know we're dead stop. Now, are we going to be sincere and look at that? What's going on here? Where am I in a holding pattern? Where am I arresting myself? Often because of the pain issues. Okay, go from Eightfold Path back up to number first truth. Follow it back down again. Where am I hurting? Why am I hurting? And what do I need to alleviate that hurting? And let me do so. And then we will start moving again. It'll start moving again. When there's no fluidity, there's no movement, when there's no... when you just feel this kind of lifeless energy in you. Remember the word interconnection. How can that word be lifeless? You see, if you keep holding wise view and keep bringing what you're doing and just look to see how those two are in alignment. How well do those two, how well are those two in cooperation with one another? And when you think of interconnection and you think of being cut off or feeling dry, then we know something's awful wrong here. If we're willing to admit it. And when we're practicing the techniques of mindfulness through our own mastery of trying to do that, and every forgetful moment we lambaste ourselves for having missed that opportunity to be alive, and all of the burdens of mindfulness and all of that, and the pain of how we're approaching our spiritual endeavor. I mean, at one time, I was sitting in front of, this was after, before I went to Burma, but it really started me off on the track of wise effort. A teacher I had says, well, you know, you have fantastic concentration, he said, but you have no understanding. Which is everything. Essentially, he says, you have a nice bathing suit, but you don't know how to swim. So I say, okay, how do I get that? You see? Wouldn't you? How do I get that? Okay, if I need that, just tell me how to get it. You know, if I want to build wisdom, I'll build wisdom. I build concentration, I'll build wisdom. You know, that's the only thing I knew to do. It wasn't that it was wrong, it was the only thing I knew to do. And for him to say that and leave me nothing, well, what would I then? Well, then it was hopeless. Then I would just give up because that was the other possibility. But what I didn't have at that point was wise view. And to know the direction this thing was to take, which is what we're spending all this time on, so that you won't make these mistakes. So you say, okay, wait a second here. Let me look at this anew. Let me look at this. Let me wake myself up to this problem I've been having here. What's wrong? I feel like I'm doing everything right and everything seems wrong. You ever had one of those meditative days? You sit down, your life is cleared out, your kids are out of home, you've set the timer for 45 minutes, and your mind can't be found. Now, there's a paradox. You see, that's the limitation of science. We talked about its value, how it's predictable, how it gives you a map, a territory. It gives you something you can count on. We love that, you see. We want that map. The map to truth. But you see, here's the paradox of science. Because although science, the science of the practice, proclaims your own willfulness as its major tool, it also is the most disempowering, it's totally disempowering, because nothing is asked of you except your force of will. No intelligence or wisdom, no self-understanding. No real change in you is being asked, just more effort. And those are the very forces of empowerment. The ability to change oneself, the ability to be able to discern and to see and to observe and to understand, those are what the empowerment of spiritual practice is all about. But science doesn't promise that. The science of the practice, the predictable result, the technique, the mechanics of it. All that gives you is force of will. That's all it will ever do is sharpen that particular muscle in you. I have a very good friend. And I was just speaking with her, and she's a very experienced meditator. I mean, she has gone through the Community Dharma Leadership Program and has years under her belt. And so I was just talking to her about effort. And she says, "What?" And it's because she had never framed it like this. She didn't frame it in terms of wise view and wise intention. It scared her when I was talking about this. And she said, if I give up my effort, I just think I'll be indulgent. See, I'll just become indulgent. You see, the point is that I'm not asking you to give up your effort. I'm asking you to see the limitations of the effort you're already using. I'm not asking you to move on ahead of yourself. Just look at what seems to be the indications of the limitations of what we're doing in our practice. See the value, what we're doing it for, and why we seem to be continuing to do it, and what the limitations are in that. Again, this is not to move you ahead of yourself, but the way you move at all in this evolution is to see the limitations of the holding of what it is that continues to define how we and why we sit. That's how we move forward. Through awareness and wisdom and understanding of the particular situation, what we're doing to ourselves through our own effort. Now, effort begins to move to art at this point. When we feel the mechanics having betrayed us, okay, I still sit down and follow my breath from time to time. It's not that those mechanics aren't important from time to time. It's just that there's a whole view associated with them that we get lost in. This view of getting out of ourselves, of self-betterment, of spiritual self-betterment, that I think Trungpa Rinpoche called it spiritual materialism. So now, see, we have to allow the art in, because all spirituality in its final display is art. Would you expect something else? If you could build this thing, make it into a self-project, great, go do it. But you can't. That's why we group together. That's why we're one shared heart. That's why we all come to learn from one another. Because it's art. It's all art. And now we move from the mechanics of our rightness, because mechanics have a certain sense of rightness, and argument, and view, and opinion, to the wonder of art. Now here's, you see, there's not a lot I can say about the wonder of art except you're on your own. Except this is the call for observation, for looking, for learning, for seeing, for oneself. And even as we begin to see the limitations of our effort, we're bringing in the art of the meditation into that effort. Before it was just self-driven. Now we're beginning to, what is this doing to me? Why are all these scars on my body? Why are these scars on my mind? Now when we notice that, we're already moving into the art. The art comes from the still point, from the quiet, not from the mechanics, not from a well-oiled machine. Before, we were efforting towards an idea of enlightenment, towards an idea of goodness, and we began to see through art that our efforts to be good are working against that very quality. Isn't that interesting? None of you can be good on your own efforts. Forget it. Drop it. You'll be miserable in your attempt to be good. I can promise you that. But you won't be genuinely, authentically good, kind. This is not self-made. This is not self-made. You ever seen the painting The Scream by Munch? That's what he's yelling. This is not self-made. You see, when you have an idea of where you're going, which is the science of it, then everything else that doesn't relate to that idea is extra. I don't have time for that. I don't have time for that. I don't have time for the limitations of what I'm doing. I don't have time to look and see. I don't have time to be affected by things. I don't have time for the sensitivity stuff. I'm in movement, man. And the art is this way. The art is opening up. We have time for everything. And you're touched by everything. And everything affects you. You see, now your effort changes. Because you're not driving your car 60 miles an hour. You have a chance to look out the window. And believe it or not, you want to slow down because you want to see more. Because you know what happens when we see more? The juice starts coming back into our practice. Duh. Oh, wow, so this is how this works. The heart begins to warm. And all this depends on knowing your pain issues. Know your pain issues. Don't forget the first noble truth. Now, I've spent a year on this thing with you people. If next January 1, you're going, what pain? What's that about pain? I will have failed. And my... Because science hides the pain issues. And if you're not picking the pain issues up, you know you're in the mechanics. And when you start picking the pain issues up, you're going to move. You're going to start evolving. And your effort is going to start evolving. And your journey is going to start evolving. And it won't be just going from here to there. And you'll understand when the Buddha says this. And so, perfected in understanding, the wise dissipate all clinging. They have seen how the forces of becoming can be stopped. One insight is that effort is the basis of all suffering. that complete cooling and cessation of effort, there will be no more suffering. Every form of suffering grows out of effort. Eradicate effort and no more suffering is produced. Listen to this. This is the Buddha speaking. Consider this harmful consequence of effort, that it is the basis of suffering. But when all effort has abandoned, there is the freedom of the effortless. So suffer. Suffer with your effort, but know you're suffering. See, that's what he's saying. He says, okay, understand that the extinguishment, the final fruit, is effortless living without resistance. So at least in your effort, in your struggles, in your need to move yourself forward, pay attention to the pain that is generated through that need. In the paying attention to that, you will release yourself from the need to have to do that. And you will find yourself falling off the back end of the boat into effortless living, because you can't effort your way towards effortless living. Those are an oxymoron. And may I give you one word that can show us immediately where that pain may be hiding? And the word is kindness. And the word kindness brings in wise view. Immediately, doesn't it? Just feel yourself being tender in kindness. Feel yourself be the softness of kindness. And suddenly, inclusivity becomes the model for that view, to hold that word. And also one's own inclusivity within all. And so self-kindness becomes an equally important component of that word kindness. Kindness. I went to Oregon State Penitentiary a few years ago to look at their hospice program down there. And one of the prisoners told me a story. When he was 18, he killed a friend in rage because his friend was having an affair with his girlfriend or something. I don't even remember the details, but he killed this person. And now he was 30. 12 years had passed, and he had had a hospice patient. And this hospice patient that he had had died on the same day that he had murdered that friend 12 years earlier. And this man, who was 30 and hardened from being in jail for that length of time, eyes, I just remember his eyes and face just melting when he was telling this story. In kindness. See, he was bringing kindness to bear upon his life, in that life. I could see that as long as he was being driven by that word, which he was, through his hospice work, that he would get out of there a better person than he went in. And many of them were just doing the opposite. They were adding strength and muscle and, you know, force and angst and anyway. So from time to time, ask, what is the point of the effort I'm making? It's a question that will scare you to death. But that means it holds something for you. When there's that kind of fear around a question, it holds equal amount of discovery, equal potential of discovery. Don't just do this thing according to the text. Don't just read the Visuddhimagga and start. Don't do that to yourself. Bring life into it. This Buddhism was spoken from life, from the proclamation of life. The Buddha was alive. He spoke from life, to life. He didn't textbook it. To follow a blueprint to our salvation is to deaden ourselves all along the way. What is the value in limitation of what I'm doing? Why am I doing it? And what hurts in my doing it? And is this taking me to effortless living? Right? Where the juice flows. And we would see mileposts. There is no question you will see mileposts along the way. The mileposts of a warming heart, a little more attention, a little less reactivity, greater sensitivity, greater kindness. And the doubt, you see, what the science covers over is doubt. It covers over doubt because it gives you a professed way to move. But so we have to look at our doubt when we fall back into the art. The doubt of self-doubt, can I do it? Which I have given, giving away my empowerment to the science now. Now I'm really have to look at the doubt which has been covered over up until this point through my need to follow the map, the territory, the terrain of this particular technique. Are we willing to look at the doubt that comes forward in the art but is covered by the science? Self-doubt or just doubt in the Dharma? I hear that now more and more as I'm glad. I want to hear that. Bring it out. It doesn't scare me in the least. It doesn't throw me into doubt. In fact, if anything, I can perhaps work with you to get you out of it. And so we use each thing, everything we need. We look at everything that's happening to us because that's the art. The art just denies nothing. Doesn't look ahead of oneself, it looks at oneself. It doesn't try to lean forward, it leans into. And everything then, everything. There's no direction in this because it's 360. It's not north any more than it's south or west or east. And it's coming at me 360. And I'm on fire with it. It's not mechanical, it's alive. And it no longer hurts because I turn to where it hurts. Because I'm interested in kindness, I turn to where I'm hurting myself to alleviate that hurt. And I alleviate that hurt because my direction is one of kindness, of inclusion, of interconnection, because I have not forgotten wise view. And I'm not going to follow my mistrusting ways or my self-hatred ways. That's just pain. I can look at that. Or my anti-authority things. All of that. I just look at it. I just want to look. Just let me look. I want to see it. If you want to see it, you will. It's that simple. If you want to be driven out of it and react to it, you will. But when you understand where this takes you, you will be hungry for your own pain. And I wish every one of you an evolution towards effortless living. Thank you. And if we can sit for a minute or two. Okay, if there are any questions or comments, you're welcome to bring them forth. Yes.
Bhatia, I find there's a very fine line between relaxed and intimate practice and just getting caught up in thought. I find it's a very difficult thing in meditation. How can I be really relaxed and just having a good old thing?
That's the question is having to do with relaxing into one's practice and that very fine line between that where it makes you awake and where it makes you just kind of asleep to the thinking. You see, what you relax the resistance. But your aliveness doesn't relax. It's not a call for indulging in the feeling of relaxation. You see, it's what happens is that we're used to relaxing in order to sleep or relaxing in order not to be stressful. So there's a kind of way that we think of relaxation often in terms of a kind of indulgence, you know, sleeping or hanging out in a sauna or getting a massage or something like that. Not that those things aren't worthwhile, but that there can be a kind of accompaniment of pleasurable rest and mentally pleasurably resting at that point. This calls for something else. It calls for non-tension, a release of muscle tone associated with something that we might fear. But then when you release resistance, your fear comes back in. And so it often makes us more awake to, if we are aware of, I mean, just right now, if you just relax, you see, there's a certain way that your boundaries will start moving out like a rock with the concentric circles going out. And there's some place that we will arrest that water pattern, those concentric circles, and say, wait a minute, not there. Whoa. That's where we refuse to relax. So if we go to that place that gets a little bit where you don't know yourself quite as well, suddenly there's a lot of energy that comes through that place. Although it's not tension, it's can't be. Well, what's going on here? Can't be interest, the interest of looking. So we're trying to couple relaxation with that interest. You have to be very careful because thoughts, if you don't have that energy, and if the mind gets relaxed, so it gets kind of indulgent in the comfort of it, it'll get lost in sort of the sine wave of just the pleasurable undulation of thinking, and it'll just drift. At that point, you want to arouse the energy, but not take yourself out of the relaxation. Okay? Sounds contradictory, but actually those are two different things. One, the relaxation and the edge of one's relaxation is really due to a resistant fear, to what I'm afraid would happen if I gave up and released this objection I have. Okay, so that's not what we're looking for here. We're really looking, I mean, that is what we're trying to do there, but we're not trying to let our mind get swayed into the feeling tone of relaxation where the comfort becomes what's important to me, not the seeing. The seeing's in what's important, not the comfort here. Yes, it'll be comfortable, and yes, it'll be tensionless, and yes, it'll be very alluring in terms of the compelling states that arise from that loss of tension, but we don't want to lose ourselves in that. You stay very keen to that. And when you stay keen to it, you begin to see not only that, but the next level of resistance that we haven't given ourselves up, that we haven't given up yet. And that's how it works. And I don't want to take away the need to go back and follow our breath. Some of us need to cultivate more concentration. Some of us need that. We need more time on the cushion going through the mechanics. As I mentioned in this talk, it's not without its benefit. It has immense benefit. But you also want to, so you see that growing in you, and you also see the tension that comes with the concentration. So you try to relax that, and you also keep, just, you stay aware of all the different ways that we are giving away a totality of inclusive seeing. And when you're concentrated on just one thing, you aren't seeing anything else. And that limitation of perspective ultimately has pain as its result. We'll talk much more about this. This is not a small thing. I'm just giving you a taste tonight. Anyone? Yes.
Yeah. Natural alignment with things. And I just notice when in my daily life that sometimes that I'll do things
you know, I'll come across them and I'll say, no, that's not wise without having a real logical reason why.
You just feel it, huh?
You just feel it, and it's like, that's not...
That's not, right. That's not something's wrong there, right?
It seems yep. like, with wise effort at least, when I think about the most rewarding things in my life, and somebody will say, wow, that took a lot of effort. You just say, that's just what I do.
Right, you're interested.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, see, that offsets the effort. So when you've put forth a lot of effort and somebody will come up and say, wow, you know, how'd you ever do that?
Right.
Oftentimes, what carried you through wasn't your force of will. It was your interest. And interest then becomes the invitation for effort. What happens, as I've mentioned in an earlier talk, is that you get interested in where it is that you're causing yourself pain because you're being led by the intention of kindness. And so when you're led through the intention in the direction of kindness, inclusivity, you're going to want to know, you're interested in where you're not being kind to yourself, which is where you're causing yourself pain. And so there's an invitation that comes through that, which very naturally springs forth an enormous amount of joy and interest in uncovering yourself and not doing this to yourself anymore. You see? That's part of the whole evolution of effort. Interest, the infusion of interest along the way. It's very important. So that you wonder what it is when you give up your effort, if it's going to be indulgent. It's not. You get interested. Because the possibilities of what you can see and the result of what you can correct is immense at that point. And you go, whoa, this is, when you're just on your breath, you see it's so limited as to what you're knowing and what you're seeing. But when you start opening it up, it goes, whoa, this is big. This is, I could go here, and I got that, okay, let me look at that. And now I've, let me look at that one. And I hate authority, let me look at that one. And I'm mistrustful of everything. What's that about? Well, it's my father-in-law. What does that have to do with now? What does that mistrust have to do with now? Always ask it from that point of view. Not what it had to do then. What it had to do with then was what it did to you. But what does it have to do now? If you just ask yourself that and emphasize now, where is there something to mistrust? Okay, now why can't I relax? Okay, got it. See? Just keep bringing that forward.
But it's almost like the interest, actually. I didn't think about the interest, but the interest almost, not only the interest, but it, I don't know, there's something about the interest and the effort in how just kind of interest.
Yes. Well, just watch the connection between interest and effort. The effort is effortless when there is interest. It's not like it's just effortless. I mean, if you're doing something you love, like gardening, you get a lot of work done and it's effortless. You loved it, right? It's that sort of thing. When you start loving what you're doing in this, because there's nothing, if you do it right, at a certain point, there's nothing more interesting than this.
And that's what you're talking about,
that's it. Effortless
living.
That's exactly right. Okay. That's right. Because everything is interesting at some point, right? Whoa.
The way I like to put it is to give up the striving. So, you know, detrimental effort.
Yes. To give up the striving. The striving is a form of detrimental effort. It's not the only detrimental effort, okay? Ambitious effort, the effort that takes you out of yourself, that looks ahead of yourself, is journeying ahead of yourself. It's you can hear it even in the description how unwise it is, right? Right? But it becomes much more subtle. It becomes much more driven by perhaps comfort rather than taking yourself out of it yourself. You just want a better life. You just want a better moment, a better experience in this one, you see. So although it's still striving, it's often not that miles away or years away, and it doesn't have that kind of longitudinal approach to it. So you can be as equally interested in the pleasure of the moment as you can to the fear of it not continuing. You see, okay, well, wait a second. Now, what if this went away? Okay, got it. See, now you're no longer grasping it because you've just seen its limitation. Okay, I've got it now. So now the grasping ends. When you see the limitation, which is driving the need to grasp it, to hold on to it, and when you see that the grasping itself is fear of it leaving, and you also know, because you've worked with yourself enough, that it's going to leave anyway, whether you want it to or not, and then you just take your hand like that and you go like this. And you let the bird land and you let the bird fly. Yes.
The relationship between doubt and effort.
Yes.
I find that, because I deal with a lot of doubt,
yes,
that when it comes up, I then want to put more effort on it. And
yes.
Just when I was thinking about it, it seems like what that's doing is reinforcing my belief in the doubt.
That's exactly what you're doing. Very wise there, Suze. She says that sometimes doubt. And may I say that if you don't have doubt in this practice somewhere along the line, that there's quite likely you're too mechanical in your practice, because doubt is an accompanying quality. It's everything that you've ever learned has been turned around on you. And when everything gets turned around so that going forward is going backward, and going backward is means something completely different, then why wouldn't you doubt that? If you had any sense, everyone's going to doubt that. So you're not alone in this. And then you begin to see that when you try harder in the middle of doubt, you're just going back to the mechanics of the approach, which cover over the expression or feeling of doubt. Where I would take you is into the feeling of doubt. And don't be afraid of it. Don't be afraid of it. I had tremendous amount of doubt. Because I had all these things to such an enormous extent, I can talk about them and say, come on. I mean, I just was racked with it. But what was very helpful for me in those kind of doubts is not to try to get out of it, was to say, look, there are a lot, go into East West Bookstore and look around and say, now, is everybody in here lying? is this a kind of a conspiracy of, I mean, you know, you start with a Buddha, liar, Christ, another one, it doesn't hold up, does it? I mean, it's got to be something. I may not know it. Okay, I'll give myself that I don't know it, which is fair enough. But let me at least admit that this isn't a mass conspiracy covering 2,500 years. See, it gets a little, I mean, you can't really convince yourself too much in doubt when you really look at it. And also look what you already know. You know, one of the beautiful ways that you can learn what you already know is to pair up or mentor with somebody who knows nothing, who starts asking you questions. And you start answering questions. You go, wow, I didn't know I knew that. Often teaching can be a tremendous sense of alleviation of doubt. Tremendous refreshing. Oh, wow. And you look back and you come vast. Your journey has been vast and extensive, and you've just never given yourself credit for the depth of your understanding, you know. And small little things that seem small, little patterns that have changed, have taken tremendous amount of understanding in order to get that little switch turned off. Tremendous. Not just, yeah, no, like, you know, sometimes years of attention to those patterns. And then there's self-doubt, and that's self-betrayal. That's your belief that everyone else can do it but you, and Science will cover over that one too. That'll be one that you want to escape from. That's probably as even as hard as the doubt of the Dharma. Oh my God, I can't do it. Now listen to me. If you breathe, you can do it. That's it. That's what it takes. That and following that breath. And then following the pain of doing nothing else. That's another story. Okay. Anyone else before we get on to? Okay, thank you tonight very much.